morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to the next to the last TMR program of 2015. Next week, we have a change in schedule, but I'm going to leave that as a surprise to you. We're going to have a different speaker. But today, as you know, we're going to be talking about feeding the hungry. Also, you know that we're approaching the Christmas season, the holiday season, and we've just passed Giving Tuesday, but that's just the beginning. And we have an opportunity for you here at Thursday Morning Roundtable this week and next week to donate to the Christmas Bureau. So there's a little red kettle. There's a box, so checks, cash, books, stocking stuffers, non-perishable food. Those are the things that we're looking for, right? United Way and Salvation Army and all the rest. So, and I'm sure that if you would like to volunteer for the Christmas Bureau distribution and you don't want to navigate the system, talk to Linda Wright. She's right here. So that'll be great. So remember, another chance next week. This week, though, again, talking about feeding the hungry, and I, you know, sometimes it just works out. I was able to get all four people that I wanted on the panel to agree to the first date I asked them, so the stars were aligned, and I know it's going to be a very interesting as well as important conversation. So, to start us off, Kathleen Stress. Kathleen is the executive director at the Food Bank of Central New York. Mary Beth Fry. Mary Beth is the executive director at the Samaritan Center. Before she was at the Samaritan Center, we used to see her here at Thursday Morning Roundtable. I'm going to rub it in more often, but good work.
I'll be back.
You're good. You're good. We know you have a lot to do. John Tumino is the founder of In My Father's Kitchen, and Alan Thornton has been with us before. Alan is the CEO of the Rescue Mission. So Kathleen is going to get it started. They're going to tell you a little bit about each of their organizations, and we have a few slides, and then we'll have time at the end for questions, as always, and I'll come around to you with the mics. So if you have a question, just raise your hand up high, and we'll try to get to you. Kathleen, thank you. Take it away.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
We start with just a primary overview. So for those of you who may not know, Food Bank serves an 11-county region, so we geographically cover about 25% of the state. And our role is to ensure that emergency food programs, so food pantries, soup kitchens, and emergency shelters, have the food resources they need to feed their local communities. So programs like Samaritan Center are soup kitchens. And then we also have some non-emergency programs, such as daycare centers, senior centers, and residential programs that also utilize us for their food resources. We were founded back in 1985, so we're celebrated 30 years of service. Someday I'll work myself out of a job, but as I'm here today, there is still a need to feed the hungry. We currently have 356 programs, and that includes the emergency programs as well as non-emergency programs, that Food Bank goes out to deliver to. So Monday through Friday, we are out delivering directly door-to-door to those programs. So whether it's a professional organization, whether it's volunteer-run, whether you're in a home, like a residential area, you're in a church, we're making sure that we're delivering those items that you need. So what are those items? What is it that the Food Bank is supplying? We have three different types of commodities. So we rely heavily on donated food. So that's about a third of our inventory. And what that is comprised of is, so food drives this time of year is a typical donated item. But also throughout the year, we have companies, organizations, and then we have a retail partnership program where we work with the community. So it's the Wegmans, Walmart, Sam's Clubs, Hannaford's, where we're accepting what they consider not sellable, but it's still very usable food items, and we're collecting that on a daily basis and distributing out to our programs. So it could be fresh produce and vegetables, fruits and vegetables. It could be high-quality cuts of meat. So those are frozen ahead of time. So it's the chicken, the pot roast. It's no longer just hamburger, you know, ground round and hot dogs that were distributed in days gone by. And then we also have dry items. So that's about a third of our inventory. Then we rely on USDA. So the Farm Bill, which was in lots of discussions the last couple of years, that's an important piece for us in order to acquire USDA commodities. And then our final one is wholesale product, and that's where we rely on grants. We have a large grant through Department of Health that funds our purchase program. And that's where we're really able to focus on more nutritious commodities. So we make sure that the canned items we provide, for example, are low sodium, that the fruits are in either water or a light juice versus the heavy syrups. And then we're able to focus on more name brand cereals and grains and pastas and rices. So that's the three commodity streams. And I thought I would just share how we acquire our food. So we're acquiring it from those three commodity streams, and we're then making sure that it comes back to the warehouse before distribution to really review food safety. So when there's a food drive, we want to make sure that those canned items, if we get them, that the expiration is not way past due, that the if there is a dent in that can, that it's not on a seam to compromise it, if the packages are ripped, if there's any kind of rodent contamination. So it has to go through a lengthy food safety process. The only time that we are not bringing it back to the warehouse is when we're stopping at our retail partners. We're picking up those perishable items, and then we're stopping at designated programs along the way to distribute those immediately because they are perishable. So the programs are taking them. Their volunteers are going to go through them a little to make sure if there's any rotten tomatoes or things, that those are going to be discarded. And then it comes back to the food bank, and we're sorting that food. So if you have not had the opportunity, I invite you for a tour to the food bank. It's like the Costco of emergency food. So we have a large warehouse in which we're able to house the materials. So it's a 74,000 square foot warehouse, and it's a 25,000 square foot freezer cooler that we have at the distribution center. So today may not be the great day to come out and walk through the cooler freezer, but in the summer I invite you out and it's really refreshing. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we partner with 356 programs, and whether again they're professionally run or they are volunteer run, those are the programs that make us tick. So as much as we provide the food, it's the opportunity that they're then feeding the community. So we ensure that they have the food resources, but really there are a link to the direct service of the meals. And then I just wanted to cover a little about who is hungry. So I think what sometimes we forget about is that hunger exists here locally in our community. And over the years, the face of hunger has changed. So what was once, probably about 10 years ago, considered the homeless man standing on the corner who could access a meal at a soup kitchen was the face of hunger, has now shifted dramatically to more families. And it's families who are trying to make ends meet. So it's not just those who are unemployed. It's families who are employed, who before the recession were also employed at a higher wage level, might now be re-employed, but they're having two part-time jobs to make ends meet, or they're employed at a lower level. We did a study in 2013. It was a regional hunger assessment, and we went out and talked to 374 recipients of the emergency food programs. And what we found out was that really only about 10% of them, of them, 10% have no health insurance. About 72% of them have an education of high school or college. So again, it's not just someone who has dropped out of high school or is not employed. 91% of the families we serve are living below the poverty level. And again, these are families who are trying to make ends meet. They are working. They just are at that threshold that they don't have a high income. So they're making the decision between, do I eat? Do I pay my bill? This time of year, do I eat? Do I pay the heat bill? Is it medical? Is it transportation? So what we typically find is that families might skimp, and that they'll skip a meal or they'll feed their children because they don't have the food resources in their home in order to provide 5 days of meals or 7 days of meals. And then just another interesting tidbit is when we did the study and when we look at our service numbers now, we serve about 30% of the recipients of the emergency food programs are kids under the age of 18. So not only is it adults, but we have a high volume of children that are being serviced through the Emergency Food Network, as well as about 10% our senior population. So how do we work on that? How do we focus? Well, certainly I'll turn it over to my esteemed panel to share about their daily work. But in addition to food resources that the food bank is providing, we're ensuring that when you come into a pantry for service, we're hopefully going to connect with you, because you're going to probably come back more than once, and we're going to talk with you and find out what the situation is. We're going to see if you're eligible for SNAP, which was what used to be food stamps. We're going to see if you're eligible for HEAP, what type of Child Family Health Plus might you be eligible for. So we're going to work through the referral system to ensure that not only are you receiving those meal packages for your families, but you're also receiving the services you might be entitled to. So I'll turn it over to Mayor Beth, who is one of the food bank programs, but she has been doing this work for years, so she can speak to what they're seeing on a daily basis.
Thanks, Kathleen. I think the first thing I'd like to say is while you'll hear from each of us, right, this whole system works as a network. It's really a partnership of organizations that support each other and then support the person that's coming to each organization. So, I mean, for example, Alan's homeless outreach worker will come to the Samaritan Center and link in with folks to try to get them housed. John stops by and checks on his guys that he's checking on under the bridge. Kathleen, she talks about fresh fruits and vegetables, right? Impossible to get a hold of for any reasonable price except through the food bank. So, I mean, it's all this whole network that comes together to really make the whole system work. The Samaritan Center, I don't know how to work this.
Just go, there's right here, this little arrow.
Yeah, this is why they threw me out of TMR. I couldn't do any of this.
Want me to do that for you?
Yeah. We actually have been around for 34 years. So we started about the same time that the Central New York Food Bank did. And recently moved to the former St. John the Evangelist Church because of the numbers of people that we were seeing in need. Last year we served about 122,000 meals to folks in need. And then since we moved, we've seen about a 3-4% increase each month as we've been in this new facility. To kind of capture who we are, we're a little bit wonky, right? Which it makes sense that I'm in charge of this place, but we're a little bit backwards from a lot of social service agencies, right? It's a no questions asked operation. So if you're hungry, you're welcome. And then what we do is very similar to what Kathleen says. We try to get to know people as Kathleen, as Alan, as John, which makes the questions that people need to ask to take the next step in their life that much easier, right? So people that are saying, you know, my husband is abusing me and I don't know what to do. My son has schizophrenia and I'm at my wit's end and I really don't know where to go. That's a question you can ask Mary Beth. It's very difficult to ask that to a social service where you're kind of coming in and registering and doing income and doing. It's really a relationship-based model. And it really creates this sort of level of safety and comfort that lets people look to what the next step in their life would be. As Kathleen had said, I guess if I was going to do a snapshot of who we'd serve, if you think about law of thirds, right? About a third of our folks would be people that you might see under the bridges or in the shelters or someone you might see on a stoop in downtown Syracuse. Those are sort of the people that first come to mind when you think of a community meal site. Second third are those folks that Kathleen mentioned are the working poor. They're folks that during a transition are running into difficulty meeting their needs. Maybe they've lost their job. Maybe their houses got foreclosed. Maybe they had a medical bill that they had to pay, which then food is where your budget is fungible, right? If you don't eat, you're hungry. But if you don't pay your heating bill, you're freezing to death, right? So food is where people tend to wiggle. That's that second third. Those folks are with us for a brief period of time during a transition or a crisis, and then we might not see them again. The final third of folks that we serve are folks that, if you think about a competitive society, have difficulty competing. They might have traumatic brain injuries. They might have PTSD. They might have mental health issues. They might have some substance abuse issues they're trying to work through. And those are folks that we tend to see for a much longer period of time in our services because we really become part of what makes their life work and part of their support system. I think one of the things John will talk about is none of us here is trying to create this reliance system, right? It's all about self-sufficiency, and it's all about trying to help people get to the next step. It takes those organic relationships that people are able to create within an organization where they come to share a meal, where they come to break bread and share their own skills and their own experiences. That stuff continues outside of our organizations. And that's really the holy grail, right? Because it's not about us. It's about helping people create this support system and this network that helps them move on to a better and different life. I guess the final thing I'd say, well, I never say the final thing. If you think about hunger as a proxy for poverty, right? When you read poverty statistics about Syracuse being the second in the nation in terms of a city of its size in terms of poverty, that shows up within the emergency food system. We tend to be if you think about leading and lagging indicators, right? We lead the economy when it's starting to go down. Our people are the first people that get hit when the economy hits a difficult period. As the economy starts to improve, we lag, right? We're the last people that start to see that improvement in the economy. So you can really watch sort of that macroeconomic poverty stuff happen within the food system level, because that's where it starts to show up first and then last in a recovery. The other thing I'd say is we are primarily a volunteer operation. So we're up to 7 staff at our organization and about 800 volunteers a month. So it really exists because a community has decided that this is a service that should be there. This is something that we need to address as a community. And they come, I mean, at 5 in the morning to help cook eggs, and they stay till 6 at night to mop floors. So in terms of, you know, community, that's what happens at organizations like you're seeing here. It's a community coming together to help itself. And there was a final thing I wanted to say, but I don't quite remember what it was. It was good, but maybe it'll come up in question. I will get back to TMR. I thank you for allowing us to be here to talk about what it is we do. And I think you'll be incredibly impressed by all the people here. But again, I think it's really important to know that your community is working well together. And they're working as partners to try to address this, what seems to be a really huge problem. But as we chip away one meal at a time, right, at one person at a time and one situation at a time, we make a difference.
Going down.
Oh.
Thank you.
Hit that.
Well, thank you for having me. You know, the cool thing is food brings people to the table. And what Mary Beth was saying, the main thing that we all do up here is collaborate with each other and other agencies. You know, we can't do it by ourselves. We need each other, and it's locking arms, because a lot of us, we're touching the same people as we're interacting with individuals outside. So collaboration in my father's kitchen is the huge thing. I can't house you, but I know who can house you. You know what I mean? I might not be able to help you with your mental health issues, but I know who can. You know, I might not be able to help you with your substance abuse problems, but I know who can do that for you. So with us, I'm wearing a chef coat, and I have my little chef hat on. I want to just tell you a little backstory of, you know, our approach to using food is kind of an out-of-the-box scenario. I can't feed the masses. It's just my wife and I, and we have a bunch of volunteers that help us on a consistent basis. We have about 60 that consistently help us on different things that we do. And I'm the only employee of the organization. My wife is my backbone, and she helps me throughout the whole thing. She's actually a co-founder. But I owned a restaurant. I owned Osti Cafe on North Salina Street. And 4 years ago, I turned it over to my family to follow the call of the Lord. I'm also a licensed minister as well. And I just felt this calling to leave the restaurant and to go help those who feel invisible. We're kind of known for doing things with the individuals that live outside who don't want to maybe access the shelters for whatever reason, the chronically homeless. But that's only one of 2 things that we do. Another huge thing that we do is we help the refugee community in Syracuse. I live on the north side of Syracuse, born and raised in Syracuse, went to Fowler High School, graduate. I owned a business in the city. I own a home in the city. I live right in Ground Zero, and the refugees are coming to our city. So with Leanne and I, the other thing that we do with food is we help the refugee community. So for us, how we use food is I can't sustain you on a consistent basis, like, you know, like the Samaritan Center can feed you twice a day, or rescue missions feeding every day, food banks bringing food out every day. I go out twice a week, and we engage our homeless friends who live outside. And with us, food is just the vehicle that we use to build relationships with people. And once I know you and get to know you after that sandwich, I'm bringing restaurant quality food to you. So I'm not bringing peanut butter and jelly, even though that's good. I'm bringing like lasagna, stuffed peppers, linguine Alfredo, and I'll show you a picture, I think, right? This individual here, and the people that I'm going to show you here have written consent that I could show these, and they're all successfully have changed. This is Kevin, and I met Kevin 3 years ago over on Teal Ave, and that's me handing him a lunch. Today, because of the relationship we built, started with that lunch, Kevin now is employed. He was a former crack addict, sober for over 2 years. He went through Salvation Army's ARC program, and we connected with him, and I was kind of his mentor in helping him through that program. And then he volunteered with me for a long time, and then he's got a full-time job, has his own apartment, living in Weedsport, and he stops in and says hi to me from time to time, but I'm still friends with him. I don't call our friends outside clients, I call them friends. But food for us, as with Kevin, is just the vehicle that we use and we ride upon that lunch that we bring to build relationships with people. You know, I don't know you, you don't know me, I know some of you, and you're getting to hear a little bit of my heart, and it's the first contact, you know. As we dialogue more with each other, the more you know me, the more you find out about me, the more I know you, the more I find out about you, and then that's how I help these individuals. I'm part of the Homeless Housing Coalition, so like I said, it's all about collaboration, so we go back to the coalition and say, hey, we got XYZ person out there, we need this thing, and then the doors open and we get them connected. This is one of our giveaways where we work with the refugees. We do 4 giveaways into the community every year. We do a spring, summer, we do a fall, and a winter. We just did our fall giveaway. We gave away 576 bags of groceries. We gave away over 3 tons of clothing. And we just show up in Washington Square Park. That's where I live by that area. That's one park that we use. Whether we connect with other agencies like other churches, I go to Abundant Life. Sometimes we partner with Abundant Life Christian Center. And at this last giveaway, they were our partners. We partnered together, and we just loved on the community. It's all about unconditional love. So with Leanne and I, we go out with a sandwich. We love on the individual with unconditional love, and we help them get connected. It's all about the collective, as Mary Beth was saying. It's all of us up here working as a team, and the common denominator is the individual that we see outside. That's just one of our giveaways where, like I said, I'm a chef. I make lentil soup. We're just giving away soup. Soup is just a way to draw people. The food for us is just a way to get people to the table. Last week, we all celebrated Thanksgiving. What happens? We're all around a table with family that comes from all over around a bird, right? But then what happens at the table? Dialogue starts to happen. Communication starts to happen. And that's what we do when we go out to the streets. It's just bringing a little bit. Oh, I lost that last picture.
Yeah, that was tricky.
So with us, again, food, the way we approach food and how we use food is just a tool in our hand to get to know you. I call it first contact. And then we tell them that they're not invisible, that we see them and we want to help them. And then as we get going, like Mary Beth says, I'll show up at the Samaritan Center and engage with someone that we're both touching. And it's about relation building. Or I work with the Rescue Mission. They have a gentleman named Jim that goes out with Treat Outreach now. And Jim and I will call each other about an individual that we're both working on. And we're just, you know, I'll give him an update or he'll give me an update. It's all about collaborating. So it's all about the individual on the street. So food for us is just a tool. I can't keep feeding you every day. It's just about building a relationship with you. And that's kind of what we do at In My Father's Kitchen. So thank you for your time.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. First, I just want to say I think it's great that this discussion is happening at this time of the year. So I want to thank TMR for that to take place, because you think about the holiday season and you think about the role that food plays in that for each of our families, and just the heightened sensitivity to what we have and what we're grateful for, as well as the heightened sensitivity that those that might not have or be in the same position. And so I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here with everyone and just talk about this. So the Rescue Mission, we've been in existence for 128 years. Clarence Jordan founded us in 1887. and since then, we've been trying to build on that work. The role of the mission in the community is to share hope, to end hunger and homelessness, to change lives, and to strengthen communities 1% at a time. And when we talk about sharing hope, it's hope that your life does not have to look the same way it does today. It's hope that you don't have to be defined by the fact that you might feel hungry today, that you might be homeless today or unemployed or struggling with mental health issues or behavioral issues. Those things don't have to define who you are or who you could become. And a couple weeks ago, we celebrated our Hope Awards. And we celebrate the achievements of those that have come through our programs. And we had this nice dinner for them. We had about 36 awards that we presented to individuals and family members that had come through our programs. And one gentleman was coming up onto the stage to receive his award. And I was presenting the award. I shook his hand, gave him the award. And he says to me really quietly, he says, "Do you recognize me?" And at that moment, I kind of looked at him with a question on my face. And he's like, "You came and spoke to me when I was standing on a corner." And he said, "I looked a lot different then." And he talked about, later we reconnected after the award celebration, and he was a homeless individual that was on the corner, and I make it a point that whenever I roll up to a corner and there's a gentleman there, I always roll my window down and I talk to them. If I see someone, I'll go and walk over and talk to them. And I always want them to know the mission is there for them. And so he would come to the mission for a meal. And now we were celebrating the fact that he was permanently housed. And I look at that and I think that's life transformation, right? That's the hope that we have to share with each individual that comes through our doors each and every day. In terms of ending hunger and homelessness, what does that look like at the Rescue Mission? Like all of the providers here, we try to stand in the gap for those that are hungry. And so each day we provide 3 meals a day, 365 days a year, to anyone that is hungry. If you come to the mission and you need to eat, we are going to feed you. And we provide about 250,000 meals in the course of the year. So it's a massive outreach. We are involved in terms of serving as many people as possible. And that's happened because literally we've been able to do this over decades and over a century. And I think it speaks to the generosity and the support and the concern of a caring community for their neighbors that are struggling and those that are on the margins. Because the reality is none of us could be doing anything that we're doing as an organization if it wasn't for the volunteers that come in each and every day. So last week was Thanksgiving. And for the Thanksgiving meal alone, for our lunch meal, we provide about 2,000 meals. It looks a little different than normal because about 300 to 400 of them are served on our campus for the lunch of clients that are coming to the Rescue Mission. And then we send out about 1,600 meals. And we do that with the help of 450 volunteers. 450 volunteers that give up of their time, that take Thanksgiving and make it part of their tradition of giving back. And they come and they make sure that people that are in the community that are homebound, that are elderly, maybe struggling with disabilities, maybe don't have the resources to provide a meal, that they have a meal that day. And one of my friends always takes her family out, and she was highlighted recently on News Channel 9 because they followed her on one of her drop-offs. And the woman that she gave the meal to said, "I don't have any family in town, and you are the only person we're going to see today." You know, and you think about the power of that, what John's talking about. The fact that people aren't invisible, that sends a message that they matter. And so that's the touch points that we're trying to create, is let people know that they matter and take care of those basic needs that they have. In terms of who we serve demographically, largely the homeless population. We operate the largest shelter in the community. We have a 183-bed shelter that we just opened in early October. And for the first time in our history, we opened our emergency shelter doors to women as well. So right now, I get the numbers every day. We average close to 170 men and women in shelter with us on any given night. And about 30 to 35 of those are women that are homeless in our community that are coming in. So our meal numbers have gone up as a result of that. We're close to 800 meals a day that we're serving. And on top of that, though, we also serve individuals in the community that are homeless that may not be staying with us. So that maybe they're staying in one of the other shelters that are in the community. They can come to the Rescue Mission. They can receive a meal. Whenever they need to do that. But like a lot of everybody else up here, we're serving more than homeless individuals. We serve a lot of families that are residing on the Near West Side, a lot of individuals that are residing on the Near West Side, one of the poorest census tracts in the state, that are having to make those decisions between paying the heat bill, paying the rent, and putting food on the table. And so families are coming to the Rescue Mission. They're able to walk right down Gifford Street, come to the Rescue Mission, get a meal to make sure that that night their child isn't going to bed hungry. And so that's a critical role that we play. And we also, again, serve a lot of individuals that are working in the community. They're just underemployed. You know, they're not making quite enough. And so they come to the mission to make sure they don't have to spend dollars that could go elsewhere on that. So it's part for us of both a community outreach component that we do programmatically in terms of providing meals to those that are hungry in the community, as well as a continuum of services that we operate, which is caring for people that are homeless, getting them off the street into shelter, providing them with case management that's going to help them access the resources in the community that they need to ultimately build income, get access to health care, and then ultimately find housing and be able to move out of the shelter and into a place of their own. And so certainly we're providing residential meals to those that are with us, and then we're providing the community outreach meals as well. It's a large part of what we do. Going back to Thanksgiving briefly, I try to make a point of greeting all the volunteers that are coming in. And I was talking to an individual, and someone jumped out of the line, and they grabbed me, and they said, "Alan," I looked at him, I recognized this guy, but I couldn't find his name right away. He's like, "My name's Tony." And he's like, "I came through the mission in the late 90s, and I'm here today because I want to give back, and I want to serve." And he was one of multiple past recipients of meals, past recipients of programs at the Rescue Mission, that were coming back that day in order to provide meals for those that are in need. So when we talk about life transformation up here, we are looking at that. Like, we want to meet that basic need of hunger in the community, but we want that to be a starting point, because ultimately we want to journey with these individuals and help them reach their fullest potential and see their lives changed and transformed. And we know that when we do that, we're strengthening the community that we serve. And we love this community, and we want every person in it to be able to achieve their highest level of independence. So thank you so much for having us this morning.
Great, thank you. Thank you all. I just wanted to add that, I'll get to Ed. I spoke with Sarah Merrick, our DSS commissioner, couldn't be here today, and she gave me a few statistics on SNAP program. Kathleen mentioned that the food bank, when people go to the distribution locations, they can be referred to food stamps. Sarah said there are about 72,000 individuals in the county who are SNAP recipients. About 75,000 of them are in the city, 25,000 in the county. So that's not unexpected. We know there's a concentration of poverty in the city, but still 25% in the county. About 17% under 5, 17% over 65, you know, the rest in the middle. So anyway, going back to this, I'm going to be wonky like Mary Beth. So it sounds like about 15% of the county population overall getting food stamps. And although Rescue Mission, In My Father's Kitchen, Samaritan Center, all in that concentrated poverty area, there's a lot of hunger outside the city. And so I don't know, I guess my question is to Kathleen about what you see the differences and what services there are, and are the suburban or the rural poor, you know, kind of suffering more, although the numbers are smaller, some of the services aren't there. So where are those people who are on SNAP? Do they have a different demographic, or what do you see?
Well, so outside of the city or Onondaga proper, so for, let's say, St. Lawrence, for example, that's one of our counties served. There, we have 12 programs overall, and St. Lawrence is a large county but very rural. So those folks who are accessing an emergency food program are traveling a greater distance in order to get that. What you also find is access to a grocery store itself. So families who are on SNAP might have those eligibility benefits, but they're unable to access the store for the fact of it's a barrier for transportation, or it takes an hour to get there on the bus. I can only carry so many bags of groceries in order to then get back home. So from a rural standpoint, although we have programs in place, realistically and typically, a food pantry is going to provide a family with 3 meals for 3 days for each family member, possibly up to 5 days because it's supplemental. In relation to that, for SNAP, so most of our SNAP benefits for our families, they get them at the beginning of the month. It starts and runs through, their benefits may last, again, because it's supplemental, about 2.5 weeks. So let's put that together, 3 to 5 meals for 5 days plus 2.5 weeks doesn't get us through a full month. So that's when they are going to access soup kitchens. And I'm a super nerd, so I brought all our statistics. 18 of our 35 soup kitchens have seen an increase in meals serviced. When we look at last year from July to September to this year, 2015, July through September. And I'll share some other statistics. But so families are going to access the services of such as that, or they're going to skip a meal. So we have used data called Map the Meal Gap. And what we're trying to do from a food bank perspective is, how do you then initiate other services? So can we work with creating a school pantry? So there's an opportunity for families to access through there. Fire departments or libraries. Is there a local agency who would be willing to expand their hours? So if there is a program, you guys do a great job because you serve every day, but some soup kitchens serve one Saturday a month. So can we build their capacity through volunteers and access to food grant dollars in order to increase the service in which they provide? Does that help answer? Oh, there you were hiding. Help answer the question.
I would just jump in on that too, because I think Kathleen brought up a really good point, two points actually. One is trying to live on SNAP and what you can buy, what you can't buy, and just the volume of that is incredibly challenging. And we've done in the community at different points in time with Interfaith Works and things, the SNAP challenge, where you try to live for a week on the equivalent of SNAP benefits. And I tried to do that with my family, and it is really, really difficult.
It's $4 a day.
Right, so I mean, you look at, just picture trying to do that. I mean, we're gonna go out probably for lunch today and drop more than $4, right? And here you have individuals that's their entire meal budget for the day. So it's really challenging. And then on top of that, you start seeing like they're going through that very quickly and then needing other providers in the community, needing other supports like soup kitchens in the community to be able to meet that gap for them.
And can I add something to that too? Like when we help individuals get connected. So over the last 4 years, we've engaged and helped 38 individuals come indoors that were chronically homeless through various agencies. And what ends up happening is, because we befriended them and we've kind of helped them get connected, we're like the familiar face. So what ends up happening is sometimes they'll get into these apartment situations, and like Alan said and Kathleen was saying, that all of a sudden the SNAP doesn't make it. You know, so I'll get a phone call because I'm the guy that they know, and hey, John, I need your help. So we have like a small little pantry in our building that we use, and it's only, we access it not to the community, it's more to the people that we engage with. But then with us, we engage with the caseworkers that are connected with them in those agencies and say, hey, you know, Joe just called me and he's saying this. Can we let him know where a pantry's at? You know, or can we get him there? Can he get a ride there? Sometimes it's transportation to get to the pantry. You know, they might house you somewhere on the south side and your pantry's like 12 blocks away, and how are you going to walk with all these groceries? So sometimes transportation's an issue, and we provide that as well. But I said that to say it's about the engagement. It's about befriending the individuals and helping them become successful. It's teaching them life skills again. You know, you get back indoors and you don't know how to live. You know, you forget you need to wash your floors and do this, and you have to eat properly and healthy. So we engage you to help you get connected and that you come back to life. Like Alan said, transformation, transforming people from one place to another.
Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation already today, but I guess where I want to go is, there's no question what each of you do in your own organizations has made a difference in our community. I guess my real question goes, if each of you could dream and have the dream come true, what would you look for in your own organizations to either expand what you're doing, just do more of what you're doing, or some new areas that you could jump into or would make a bigger difference? Or as a collective type thing, whether it's just the four of you or other groups adding in as well. So it's dreaming a little bit.
I have a dream.
What's your dream?
The shelter systems are awesome, and what Alan does and with Catholic Charities Men's Shelter is spectacular, but some guys don't want to access a facility that has 170 individuals in it. My dream is, why can't we have satellite places that are homes that are beautiful? And like, I have a dream and a vision that I'm working on in regards to maybe bringing that to fruition. A smaller concept of maybe three individuals in a home with an overseer of a house who lives in the other apartment, and these guys are living downstairs and there's an access person upstairs. And if that little model works, why couldn't you reduplicate that model throughout the city with all these abandoned homes and redevelop it? You know what I mean? So I would say doing shelter, but at a small scale, more intimate, more relational, more like with more, I would say, in regards to aesthetically pleasing. Like, I appreciate what the rescue mission did. That facility is like state of the art. And that brings value and dignity to individuals. But I'm thinking, like, my vision and my dream, to answer your question, is bring it down to a smaller scale and then have multiple locations.
I think for me, it has more to do with some of the systemic stuff, right? It's about affordable housing. It's about access to employment. It's about education. It's all those other pieces of the puzzle that bring people to us at all. So I think it would be taking a look at that larger picture that gives people, you know, when they come out of shelter, is there a quality, affordable place for them to go? You know, that the wind isn't blowing through the windows, that, you know, it's actually warm, that, you know, they have a shot at being successful because they have a home that actually doesn't leak and the plumbing works and all those other things. I think there's some really neat things happening locally around the work train movement, right, about creating employment for folks and creating employment that employers need, right, not just training people to have a degree or to have whatever skill, but to have a skill that we need locally. And how do we partner more like that so we're giving people opportunity? The literacy programs that Community Foundation spearheads, all those things build in, right, to help people have the tools to not need us at all. So I think those are some of the sort of systemic things. I think for us personally, what we know and we see every day is you don't solve hunger by just delivering food, right? It's about all the other things that people need. And sometimes it's a case manager to say, you know, this thing down at the Civic Center is going to be tough to navigate. I'm going to go down with you.
Right.
And we're going to sit there for a couple hours and we're going to get you through this process. So when the anxiety attack happens or someone is just, you know, I can't do this, it's too frustrating. You know what? You go take a walk. I'm going to stay here and wait for your name to be called. And we're going to get through this. So sometimes it's just having the people to support people through the process that gets them to the next step. So I think we personally, that's a really pivotal point of what we do, is trying to link people into those other things that gets them out of the system completely. So it's having capacity to do that more so.
A couple comments on that. You know, I could go on and on about things that I dream for. but I think about the people that we're serving, and two issues come to mind that just, I think, are debilitating, that I think it's important for us to understand. One is just the scale and scope of mental health and mental illness issues that people are experiencing in the community, in the populations that we serve, and how debilitating that can be. And so I think what happens a lot of times, unfortunately, is we develop stereotypes of individuals, right? So of the homeless, and we project onto them what we think they are or are not doing, and without really fully understanding maybe the trauma that those individuals have experienced in their life, or the trauma that they're experiencing today, or the significant health issues that they're experiencing today. And unfortunately, we see coming through our doors regularly people that are incredibly mentally ill, and they're not in the right place. They're not who God has intended for them to be and who they would want to be. They don't know how to get out of that situation and how to get healthier because they're so fragmented and they're so vulnerable and they get preyed on by other people in the community and they get looked down upon by people in the community. And it's one of those situations where, man, if I could wave my magic wand, that would all go away. You know, we need to figure out how to get more services to those individuals so that they have a shot that when we get them into housing, they're going to be able to maintain it. So they have a shot that they can hold on to a job when we're able to connect them to employment. So that is a key piece of that. And another part of my dream is that I show up on the Rescue Mission campus one day and I don't see an ambulance that's responding to some sort of a spike overdose or heroin overdose. Not only our community, but all across the country, heroin usage and spice or spike, synthetic marijuana as it's known, is at epidemic levels. And it's incredibly challenging for law enforcement, I think, to get their arms around that, to be able to get it off the street, so that individuals that we're serving aren't caught up in it. So you can look at addiction through a couple different lenses. You can look at it through the lens of, well, these people put themselves in this position because they took something they shouldn't have. You can look at it through the lens of, well, these individuals are addicted and it's a health issue, and addiction by its nature is a health issue, and we need to figure out how to get them the services and support they need to unlock them from that. But at the end of the day, if we don't do something about it, it's not going to get better. And so the key is that regardless of how this individual has found themselves in this position, we need to care for them. We need to figure out how to get services to them that are going to help change their life and give them a shot to move forward. So I think about the people that we serve, what Mary Beth is talking about, access to affordable housing. What John's talking about, access to affordable housing, is huge. The Rescue Mission, we do work in singles and doubles with smaller projects. We have a four-bedroom apartment building on the Near West Side. We've got a three-bedroom house that we just redid with the land bank, and those are awesome initiatives. We also need to scale, though, because the size of the problem requires it. And so we're working on creating a 128-unit permanent housing facility now, 68 of those units being for homeless individuals coming out of shelter into permanent housing. And so things like that we are moving forward on, because the reality is it's a large problem, and we need to address it in order to be able to have a community that we all have an opportunity to live in and live well.
And I'll end that with, I dream that someday, soon, we'll go back to what is considered the emergency food network. Currently, we are the essential food network. Families rely heavily on us. I would like to see a society where families have access to food every day, and that we are able to increase their food security. So maybe it's not eliminating hunger, but it's increasing access. And as piggybacking off of Mary Beth, that becomes a whole partnership from a societal and systemic change. So it's partnerships with academia, with health institutions. You know, we have pediatricians who want to do health screenings for food insecurity starting. So, I mean, these are opportunities we need to embrace, but to also create momentum and to get at the table. So to not only say we're helping with food, but that we want to make a difference. So it's really forcing our hand at the table to hopefully make some societal changes.
Would you stand up?
Good morning. 2 years ago, there was a terrific flap about the Samaritan Center moving in around the corner from the Holly Green District neighborhood, which at that time had made major inroads in recovering from being a neighborhood known for the involvement of drug dealers, prostitutes, and so on. To my mind, mutually destructive to two amazing organizations. Can you talk about, Mary Beth, what progress has been made in, if any, in repairing that relationship?
I guess I would say that where we come from in that period, right, in currently, was about trying to acknowledge and respect people's passions and hearts and emotions and desires for their community. So I think there was always a respect for that. So that continues. Clearly, I think from our perspective, when we elected to step away from that particular site, for us it was about our guests, right? It was about wanting to equally respect the folks that we were serving and wanting to have our services in an environment that was respectful and most likely to support what it is that we are trying to accomplish. So I don't think we left that relationship with any sort of anger or with any sort of, it was disappointing, yes. I think it worked out for the best for us.
Yeah,
sure. I think where we are now is the perfect spot. I mean, and actually it was a spot we had looked at prior to even looking at Holly Green. So it was, and it wasn't available at that time. So, I mean, things work out for a reason, right? So from our perspective, I think there was never hard feelings about that. There was an acknowledgement of this is not the right place and that we would continue to find the right place for our guests and for the services that we were trying to provide. I know that... We have a very nice relationship with the folks from Northeast Holly Development Association and are working on some partnerships through there in terms of needs in the community and how we can help support what they're doing on the north side and the Northeast Holly. So I think this resolved well for both parties, and I think there's opportunity now to move forward positively for everyone versus kind of being stuck in this, we believe, you believe, we believe, you know, and to the detriment of both. So I'm hopeful that moving forward there's lots of opportunity.
Thank you.
This question is addressed to the rescue mission. Really have to commend you of what the rescue mission has done, especially for a young man that I was a mentee, I was a mentor for, Isaac Rivers. Mm-hmm. Fantastic job, came a long way, who's a counselor now, mm-hmm. at a young age at your facility. And my question is dealing with, in the last few years, we're talking about over 15 years, our community has seen sort of a rebellion by youth because of the poverty that we are now talking about. And we saw that in gang violence and a few others. And many of them have been sent away from their homes for quite a few years. And now they're returning back. And we're starting to see that population of incarcerated young people that are being let out of our facilities that can't stay at home, and we're starting to see them in your shelter.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about that, of how we as a community can begin to address and help those young people integrate back into our neighborhoods? They paid their debt to society. They want to move on. But when it's a big challenge with our corporations and businesses that are afraid because of what's going on right now, is putting that label on some of those that have paid their dues.
I think that's a great point. So, and thank you for your comment regarding Isaac. He is a phenomenal young man and does an amazing job each and every day at the mission. So I appreciate that. Truly cares about the people that we serve. At a macro level, the mission is the only shelter for men that takes men that are 18 to 24 into their doors. And so we see a lot of young men coming in to the rescue mission. And whether they're coming out of incarceration or whether they are aging out of foster care, which is also a contributor to homelessness, where people, you know, young men turn 18 and they're out of the foster care system and they don't have the resources, you know, to move forward. They're homeless, essentially, so they may end up at the rescue mission. Whether their families have kind of had enough and cannot manage that relationship anymore. So either way, we've got a lot of 18 and 24-year-old men coming through our doors needing attention. And I think what you're saying is imperative, because we need to intervene early, and we need to intervene effectively, or else we risk, as a community, a pattern, you know, developing for the next 10, 20, 30 years of their life. And it comes back, in my opinion, to opportunity. So when those individuals are coming into our shelter, what opportunities can we create for employment, for education, for job training, that's going to help them essentially be able to start to build their life over, whether they are coming out of incarceration or whether they are coming out of foster care? What are the resources that we can provide them as a community and help them move forward and establish themselves? So we work with, we have an employment education resource center that's in the shelter as part of the day center, that clients that are staying with us, residents, their individuals coming in for the day, can access and start connecting with potential employers, work with a vocational case manager, find opportunities. But I think employers in the community, I think it's important that we find ways to give opportunities for those, for these individuals. Otherwise, you risk them falling back into the lifestyle that got them in trouble to begin with, you know, whether it's running with the gangs, dealing drugs, small petty crime, going into larger crime. We do, I think, have an incredible challenge before us as a community. How do we get this emerging generation that's on the margin into a place where they have hope, you know, and they see a life before them that they want to live, and that they're not pulled to the wayside? You know, we'll be dealing with that for the next 20, 30 years, 40 years if we don't figure out how to intervene. So I think it's effective case management, it's access to education, access to employment opportunities, job training, but really providing them the resources they need to be able to start establishing their life over.
I like to add something to that, because we run into guys on the streets that will come out of the Justice Center or Jamesville or whatever, and the next thing you know, they're in the shelter and they land back, they're on the corner again, and I run into you. Or like Alan said, it could be someone coming through foster care. I think we've turned into a society, and I think we're getting better on it, that we're being reactive instead of being proactive to stuff. And what I think could happen a little bit better is when someone is going to be exiting, whether it's the Justice Center or foster care or wherever that situation is, that there's something happening, there's an intro, and it might be happening that I'm not aware of it, like someone calls a rescue mission and said, hey, there's an individual who's going to be coming to you from the Justice Center, and these are some skill sets that they have, and they're willing to do. There's got to be something that's happening prior to that release date from wherever they're coming and where they're landing to. Someone needs the heads up that they're coming. You know, instead of just a surprise, they're there at the mission or the cafeteria's men's shelter with bags in their hands, and they just got out of the Justice Center. So I believe there needs to be more of a proactive kind of a thing. And then the collective of employers need to step up and say, hey, we want to give guys or women a second chance or a third or fourth chance, and we're going to create an opportunity where, hey, if they get out of the center, the Justice Center, and they land at the rescue mission, then there's a quick fix to job opportunity. It doesn't have to be a huge, awesome job. It could be the first job to the next job.
So every Tuesday this summer, the food bank did an amazing job at the downtown farmers market, doing education programs, teaching people how to cook with the produce that was out there, giving them coupons to buy the produce, giving away really great products that they could use in the kitchen. What kinds of education programs are you all doing to help people learn proper nutrition, learn, if they don't have those SNAP benefits for the whole month, how to buy inexpensively but in a healthy way and in ways to really stretch that food out as far as they can get? What kind of programs do you guys have?
I'll start with that. Like, well, us being a small scale organization, and we have like 40 or 60 volunteers that help us, I try to find out the people who want to help us, I try to find out their skill set. So if you're going to give me your talent and your time, I want to know what you're good at. And then we, Leanne and I, have created this thing that we want to do. It's called Life Skills. So if we got you connected indoors, now you left the shelter and you got permanent housing or supportive housing, and you don't know how to budget your money. So I have accountants who are friends or people who are in the financial industry. Me being an entrepreneur and in business, my mind thinks a little bit different. So I'm applying that mindset to not-for-profit stuff. So I have friends that are in the industry that want to give back. So it's not always giving John and Leanne a check to go do what we're doing. Sometimes it's just giving me your time and your talent, so which is very important. So what we're trying to set up is this thing called Life Skills. So we stay with you once you get successfully housed, and we stay with you to make sure that you stay housed and that I don't want to see you on the corner again if you're the homeless individual. If you got indoors, I want to make sure that you stay set up that way and stay successful. So whether it's learning how to eat, you know, I have nutritionists that want to help these guys and gals learn how to eat better. Financially, like how do you open up a checking account? If they start to get cash assistance, how do you manage that cash that comes in? It might be only $180. How do we help you do that? If it's maybe you're still working with addiction or dealing with your addiction, I have people in the industry that are friends of mine who want to do some things privately to help people get on that track. So I guess to answer your question, it's life skills, teaching them how to get reacclimated and live again, but by using people in the industry to bring value and dignity to them and show them, right, we'll meet you right where you're at, right in your apartment, and we're going to love you unconditionally, and we're going to show you how to become successful again. But they still got to put in the footwork. You know, they still got to want to do those things. You can't force that upon someone. So it's even just being there watching a movie with them and sitting there for an hour in their home and just hanging out with them, things like that. I don't know if that answered your question on my end.
I think the other thing that you got to know about the food bank is they're not just at the farmer's market, no, right? So they're out at our place. So is Cornell Cooperative Extension, doing those same sort of things, cooking demonstrations, helping people think about budgeting, right? I mean, if you only have a $100 budget, there's only so far you can make this thing stretch, right? But it's giving people the tools and the skills, right, to try to stretch it as very far as they possibly can. And then, I mean, you look at a pantry, you get pomegranate seeds, right? So what the heck do I do with pomegranate seeds? That's a skill-building thing, too, right? We've had kids come through that have never had a blueberry, have never had a pear, have never had any of this fresh fruit, that then the food bank helps us allow them to have that experience and then understand kind of nutritionally. We'd have the Joslin Center come down and help teach people about diabetic tools and skills, like what should I be eating, what shouldn't I be eating, how do I, you know, rinse out my canned food so that it's healthier, it has less salt, all those sorts of things. So there's a lot of basic needs education happening.
Yeah, for us, it's easier to work with the population that we're permanently housing on our campus, just from a scale and a capacity standpoint. And the fact that if you're staying with us in emergency shelter, you may be with us for ideally less than 45 days, often less than 20. So it's difficult to do a lot of skill building in that short time period. So people that move into our permanent housing programs have case managers that are working with them on the budgeting that they have for their budget for a monthly basis. How do they go to know James? How do they work with our pantry that we have on campus and our outreach store so that they can figure out how do they make their own meals? So if you're living in permanent housing with us, you're no longer coming to the food service center. That's not because we've turned that off on you. That's because you've reached that point of self-sufficiency that you're not wanting to come to the food service center. So you are figuring out how to make your own meals. So our case manager is working with you, and then access to the pantry, and then how do you budget, just practically speaking. And then in the adult home that we operate, which is 60 beds, about 55 men in residence, it looks a little differently because we provide their meals for them. But we provide medical case management as well and nutritional case management as well for them, because a lot of them come that live with us have some substantial medical physical issues. And so we're helping them monitor whether it's their diabetes, whether it's their nutrition, whether it's their activity levels so that they're not getting sedentary. So those are kind of some of how we approach that. A lot of it is program by program with the capacity built into the program.
Kathleen?
Well, you gave a great plug, so thank you for us. We focus on nutrition year-round. We are a fortunate food bank that has 5 nutritionists on staff that do nutrition education. We as a society have lost that agricultural component. If your meal doesn't come in a box and you throw it in the microwave, you may not know how to prepare something. So we're working on when you do get the fresh fruit or vegetables at a site, how do you prepare them, but also dispelling the myth that fresh is more expensive. So it's helping with budgeting and access to that. So, you know, the farmers markets coupons are a great way to then try items, but it's an opportunity to really re-educate families on how to prepare foods.
Excellent. Thank you, Food Bank of Central New York, Samaritan Center, In My Father's Kitchen, Rescue Mission. Thank you so much.